serving the great Midwest from Chicago on Nexstar Media Group Station.
WGN Chicago.
Chicago prepares to pick a new mayor.
I really just want to see a city that does work for every single resident.
If you want change, you got to get out and vote.
Brandon Johnson.
We are going to finally retire this tale of two cities and usher in a better, stronger, safer, united city.
Paul Vallis.
We will have a safe Chicago. We will make Chicago the safest city in America.
Tonight, the two candidates go head to head on public safety.
There are lives that are on the line.
Education.
Our schools need to be returned to the community.
And your taxes.
There's enough in the city of Chicago for everyone.
I will be at the bargaining table myself.
It's time for you to decide. Live from Chicago's very own and your local election headquarters, this is the Chicago Mayoral Debate.
And good evening to you. I'm Lourdes Duarte.
And I'm Timon Bradley.
We welcome you to our debate between the candidates for mayor of Chicago with exactly 2 weeks until Election Day.
Tonight we are broadcasting live from WGN's historic Studio One, sponsored by AARP Illinois.
We want you to join in the conversation throughout the hour using the hashtag WGN Election.
Before we begin, let's set the ground rules. Candidates will have 60 seconds for each question. If there are follow-ups, candidates will have 30 seconds. And there will be up to 30 seconds allowed for any rebuttals. At the end of the debate, each candidate will have 30 seconds for closing statements.
And candidates, you will know your time is up when you hear this bell.
Tonight there is no studio audience, and candidates, we ask that you refrain from interrupting or speaking over one another for the next hour. Gentlemen, nice to see you both. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Mr. Johnson, in recent days, you have asserted flat out that you do not want to defund the police. But in July of 2020, you sponsored a resolution on the Cook County Board that said, in part, Cook County should engage in efforts to redirect funds from policing and incarceration to public services not administered by law enforcement that promote community health and safety equitably across the county. Let's remove the word defund from the equation. If elected, will you pursue moving money from the Chicago Police Department budget to pay for other services? 60 seconds.
Yeah, I'm not going to defund the police. I made that very clear. What I'm going to do is make sure that we implement a smart plan. This is why I'm very much committed to making sure that we're promoting and training 200 more detectives, because we have to solve crime in the city of Chicago. Our clearance rate is abysmal, particularly in black and brown communities. We're going to make sure that we spend to implement with all expediency the consent decree. Right? That's going to cost us conservatively $50 million. We also have to make sure that we are enforcing the laws that are on the books, particularly our red flag laws. There are individuals who have guns that should not have them. But we do that in the immediate, right? But we also have to think long term. This is why I'm committed to investing in youth employment, because this is really about prevention. The data has proven over and over again that youth employment, there's a direct correlation between that and violence reduction. We're going to make sure that we open to mental health centers, because there's a great deal of trauma that we're experiencing throughout the entire city of Chicago. But that's why I'm also going to pass Treatment Not Trauma. That's going to provide first responders to respond to what 40% of the 911 calls are, which are mental health crises. We can't keep asking police officers to do their job and someone else's. By actually passing Treatment Not Trauma, that frees up law enforcement to deal with the more severe violent crime.
Mr. Johnson, let's stay with us. Let's be clear, because on the campaign trail, you have said that you want to eliminate the supervisors who supervise the supervisors, as well as get rid of the graphic designers on the police payroll. In total, you put out a plan to eliminate $150 million from the department's budget. You have said you want to keep it 100. Why the shift? Why are you running away from your past comments that you're going to defund the police?
It's not a shift. It's about allocating the dollars in an equitable way, in a smart way. As I said, it's going to take us $50 million to actually implement the consent decree, right? So part of that $150 actually goes towards that. It's also why we have to make sure that we're providing first responders, our police officers, with the support that they need. The consent decree calls for mental health supported services for our police officers. I'm going to do that. The best way to support workers, particularly our police officers, by making sure that their working conditions are safe. Right. And that's what I'm going to do as mayor of the city of Chicago.
Just one more question on this. Yes or no? Will there be less spending on police in a Johnson administration?
I'm not going to defund the police.
All right, Mr. Vallis, we're going to move on to you. Your public safety plan calls for a new public nuisance ordinance to enforce and prosecute misdemeanor crimes. This was your quote in the Chicago Tribune last May. It says this: hope is not a plan. A comprehensive strategy is needed to restore order and ensure public safety across the city, but especially downtown. Part of that strategy should include a renewed willingness to arrest all criminal suspects. A few weeks before that quote, a report by the city's inspector general found that black people were overwhelmingly disproportionately stopped by CPD. So how can you ensure that your plan won't put an additional burden on black and Latino Chicagoans? You have 60 seconds to answer that question.
In part because what I was referring to, by the way, was enforcing or passing and enforcing a nuisance ordinance that can that will result in people being arrested for destroying public and private property, for going in and basically stealing or burglaries, or for that matter, in effect, publicly trespassing and intimidating and even insulting people in the process. The bottom line here is that there's been a reduction of 76% in arrests since 2019, despite the fact that crime has escalated at record levels. So the police are not making arrests, and the police do not feel that they are empowered to go out and make arrests. So we're not talking about going after people and arresting them for misdemeanors. We're talking about going out and actually arresting people for basically, you know, committing serious crimes, because that is, in fact, not happening today.
All right, I want to stay on this topic. You have argued for what's called proactive policing. Would you encourage a return to something like stop and frisk? If not, what would you do?
Well, first of all, Chicago's never had stop and frisk. Proactive policing is responsive policing. Look, right now, the police have made 2% arrests when it comes to car thefts, 5% arrests when it comes to shootings, 6% arrests when it comes to carjacking. Right now, half the high-priority 911 calls are not responded to because there are not enough police officers. So what I'm talking about doing is not only returning to beat integrity, but also allowing police officers to be responsive.
Staying with the subject, Mr. Johnson, you've pledged to cancel the city's contract with ShotSpotter and shut down CPD's gang database. What specific new tools do you want officers to have? 60 seconds.
You know, look, the bottom line is this, that ShotSpotter has been a failure. Even the internal investigation that looked at it said as much, right? And these tools have proven not to work. Can find a whole lot of things we can spend $10 million on. Right. And same thing with the gang database. I was happy to work alongside of my colleague on Manaya to make sure that we ended that practice, the gang database on the county side. There was an 8-year-old on that list, and there was a 108-year-old on that list. Now, if there's a 108-year-old out there that's still gangbanging, I would call that into question. And the fact that we have an 8-year-old on that list is also actually quite alarming. So here's the tools that we have to provide. We need 200 more detectives because we have to solve crime. One of the greatest deterrents to crime is to make sure we're catching people. But we also have to get at the root causes of the violence that exists. Our public safety plan is about prevention. And that's why I'm investing in critical services like mental health services, jobs, because these are the things that actually prevent crime. And that's what my goal is. And that's what I'll do as mayor of the city of Chicago.
All right. For this next question, we're going to give you both 30 seconds to answer this. Should CPD toss out the no chase policy put on the books under Mayor Lightfoot and former Superintendent David Brown? Mr. Vallis, I'm going to start with you. You have 30 seconds.
Well, first of all, CPD actually has a chase policy. It's a foot pursuit policy. So they have not gotten rid of foot pursuits. They have just basically inundated the foot pursuit policy with a whole series of conditions under which you pursue and a series of conditions in which you disengage. So they have a foot pursuit policy. The question is it streamlined enough and basic enough so you can train the police officers in the policy in a redundant way so they're following it? So CPD has not gotten rid of its foot pursuit policy. What they've done is they've laid out very specific detailed guidelines on when you pursue.
All right, Mr. Johnson, let's move on to you. 30 seconds, same question.
We have a consent decree that we have to implement. We have to make sure that the policies that are we are putting forth reflect the values of the city of Chicago. The fact of the matter is that the strained relationships between law enforcement, particularly in black and brown communities, is something that we have to repair. And the foot pursuit has certainly caused a great deal of harm. And I will never forget the life of Adam Toledo. And when we see the type of brutality that exists in the city of Chicago, as mayor, we have to make sure that that's not tolerated.
All right, if you win, and this will also go to both of you, you will be taking office directly before the Memorial Day holiday weekend. And last year, if you remember, 52 people were shot during that time. So beyond your four-year agenda, what is your specific plan to stop violence immediately on Chicago streets? So that means the week you take office, what will you be doing? Mr. Johnson, let's start with you. You have 60 seconds.
Yeah, look, violence in the city of Chicago is a terrible problem. We're all suffering through it. I've mentioned this before. I live in a beautiful community on the west side of Chicago, but it is one of the more violent neighborhoods. So I have tremendous incentive to make sure that when we wake up every single day, that we're not losing lives. And that's why on day one, we're going to move towards promoting and hiring 200 more detectives. We're going to work with the district council members who have been duly elected to come up with strategies at the very local level. But we're also going to work with police and the new superintendent to come up with a plan. It's very clear we don't have a plan. The fact that we have so much chaos, we haven't had a plan in the city of Chicago for the last couple of administrations. But this requires us to work with the district council members, to work with violence prevention providers, to work with the faith community, work with the business community, to work with law enforcement, the new superintendent that we'll appoint and find together. It's going to take all of us to build a comprehensive approach to make sure that we are saving lives. Not one individual, including the mayor, can take credit or take the responsibility of having a better, stronger, safer Chicago. We have to do it together.
Let me give you another 30 seconds, and I will get to you, Mr. Vallis. You said that from day one, you will promote officers. So do you know which officers? Do you have names? Do you have a list? Of, I mean, that's a pretty tall order to do on day one. So I'll give you 30 seconds.
Yeah, we certainly move to train and promote 200 more detectives. That's what we do day one. We start that process.
You have a list of which ones?
Well, there are a number of officers who want to be promoted. So, yes, we move towards that on day one, but we also have to make sure that we are working collaboratively. Look, here's the problem with the city of Chicago, that we have gotten accustomed to a dictator dictating what the city of Chicago deserves and needs. I'm going to work with law enforcement. I'm going to work with the faith community, the business community, district council members to come up with a plan to make sure that we're saving lives.
Okay, thank you for your answer. Let's move on to Mr. Vallis. Same question. What is your specific plan to stop violence immediately on Chicago streets? So that means the week that you take office, what will you be doing?
Right.
60 seconds.
Well, before I answer the question, I have to respond by basically saying promoting 200 detectives will do absolutely nothing. We have 1,700 fewer officers than we had in 2019. There's 1,100 vacancies that have not been filled, and we are bleeding officers to the tune of 80 to 90 a month because they're simply exiting. So this whole idea that somehow we're going to promote detectives and that's going to solve the problem, it's going to do absolutely nothing. Half the high priority 911 calls are not being responded to. This is what I will do when I will begin the first day after the election. I know for a fact that there are hundreds of officers who will return if there's new leadership. Also, only 53% of our officers are actually assigned to the local district, so I will push the bulk of the officers down to the local districts under local command. And I will open the school campuses, every single campus, through the holidays. In fact, just not these holidays, but successive holidays, because we have 650 schools. And why are they closed on the holidays? Why are they closed on weekends? Why are they closed into the evening hours? Those are things that we can do immediately to prepare for that holiday.
All right. I'm going to give Mr. Johnson 15 seconds for a rebuttal. Go ahead.
Yeah, look, 8% of our police department is made up of detectives versus 15% of the Los Angeles Police Department that is made up of detectives. We're behind, Paul. If you don't believe having more detectives is going to help us solve crime, then that tells you you're not ready to lead. The fact of the matter is we're behind. What I'm going to do on day one is to make sure that we have more detectives to solve crime.
Mr. Vallis, I got to give you another 15 seconds.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, if you fill the vacancies, you're automatically going to promote 200, 300 detectives. And if you promote 300 detectives from the rank and file, you're just going to be taking another 200 officers from the district. So the bottom line is fill the vacancies and invite those who have retired and those who have transferred to return in the new leadership they will. So you'll be getting an infusion of experienced officers.
All right. Come on.
Staying with public safety, in recent years, we've seen incidents of suspects charged in felony gun cases committing other crimes while out on parole or electronic monitoring. We know the elimination of cash bail is still being weighed by the Illinois Supreme Court. What do you think the consequences should be for people repeatedly arrested and charged with gun crimes? We'll start with you, Mr. Vallis, 60 seconds.
I said over and over again, when it comes to the elimination of bail, you have to distinguish between serious crimes and crimes that are not serious. You also have to distinguish between those who are habitual felons and those who are not. CWP came out, they do an assessment, and they track people who commit crimes who are out on felony bail. And by their calculations, as many as 15% of those individuals who have been arrested for murder and haven't been arrested for shooting have been people out on felony bail. In other words, they were on felony bail. And let me tell you, they were not out on felony bail for having shot or murdered somebody. They were on felony bail for assault. They were on felony bail for car theft. And a large number of them have been out on felony bail for gun violation. So at the end of the day, you've got to get serious about, if you're really going to crack down on guns, you have got to get serious about charging people who violate gun laws. Because if you don't charge them and you reduce it to misdemeanors, the federal government can then not come in and charge them under stiffer penalties and hold them accountable.
Mr. Johnson, same question, 60 seconds. What should be the consequences for people repeatedly arrested and charged with gun crimes?
Look, here's the problem, though. Someone like Paul Vallis that wants to continue to give someone like me a lecture on what I know versus what he knows is ridiculous, but I'm familiar with that. The fact of the matter is it takes up to 2 years to become a police officer in the city of Chicago. It takes 2 years. We cannot afford to wait 2 years for public safety. The question was asked, what are you going to do on day one? Paul believes that people are going to come off of retirement and come back to work after serving 25 plus years, that's ridiculous. This is why we have to make sure that we have smart policing. I've said this repeatedly, that we have to implement the laws that are on the books. There are individuals that have guns that should not have them. And if we're not being smart about policing in the city of Chicago, we're going to continue to have the same type of chaos that we've been enduring for too long.
All right, we're going to stay on that topic for a second since you brought it up. So, Mr. Vallis, I'm going to turn to you, and here's the question. You've said that there are hundreds of CPD officers ready to come out of retirement to help keep Chicago safe. However, a recent WGN Investigates report showed that 35% of CPD officers did not retire but resigned and went to work at other law enforcement agencies or other jobs. Some have also retired and left the state. So what incentives are you going to offer them to come back, and how can you guarantee that they actually will come back? And you have 60 seconds.
Well, first of all, I know for a fact that there are hundreds of officers who come back. Having been immersed in the negotiations between the police and the city, negotiations that I was involved in for free, and negotiations that included a contract that included all the accountability provisions that were demanded by the police advocates, reform advocates, there are hundreds who will return under the following conditions. Number one, they are not penalized and they do not lose their seniority. In terms of retirees coming back, there are a number of them who would like to come back and who retired simply because of the oppressive schedule and the absence of quality leadership. But there are many others who will come back in a part-time capacity to work in the Detectives Bureau, analyzing cases, protecting witnesses, responding to domestic violence complaints. So I know for a fact that there are hundreds of officers that will come in. But look, don't fool, my opponent should not fool anybody into thinking that promoting 200 detectives and not filling the 1,100 police vacancies will in any way solve the public safety problems in Chicago.
And I'm going to get to that, Mr. Johnson. You're next. A similar question for you. You have not committed to filling the more than 1,500 CPD vacancies, and you want to promote current officers to detective roles. So what is your plan to ensure that the police ranks are not further depleted? You have 60 seconds.
Yeah, look, again, we have less detectives than Los Angeles, and they have less crime. It turns out having more detectives helps us solve crime. It's a fact. And furthermore, the only way in which we can actually attract individuals that serve on the front line as police officers, we have to remove barriers. You know, the working conditions of law enforcement right now, it's not that much different than other folks who serve on the front line. I'm a teacher. And the hardest part about being a teacher, in many cases, is having to do your job and someone else's. The same Los Angeles Police Department that has 15% of their law enforcement as detectives versus 8% in the city of Chicago, Los Angeles Times released an article that the Los Angeles Police Department is asking for treatment, not trauma. Support on the front line. social workers, counselors, EMTs, so that frees up law enforcement to deal with where 60% of the violence happens, which is in 6% of the city. That's smart policing.
So your time is up, but I want to give you 30 more seconds, because mm-hmm. the question was, how do you make sure that the police ranks are not depleted if you are, in essence, promoting some of the officers to detectives? How do you fill those other roles?
There are 200 new officers that are showing up, unfortunately, from the police academy. Unfortunately, only 15 of them were black. And so we're asking about, what are we going to do immediately? That's the conversation. Can we afford to wait, City of Chicago, 2 years to fill those vacancies? But how do you expect to fill those vacancies when black and brown individuals who are applying are being kicked out because they can't pass a psychological exam? They have credit scores that are being judged by misdemeanors from a long time ago. We have to break those barriers to open up opportunities for people to actually serve.
If we're going to stay on time, we got to keep moving. So, Mr. Vallis, I'm going to stay on this topic of police. The Chicago FOP has endorsed your campaign. Members of the rank and file police union also recently reelected John Catanzara to another term as president. Catanzara has a long history of controversy. He defended the January 6th insurrectionists. He compared COVID mandates to Nazi methods. What should voters make of the fact that officers have put their support behind both Catanzara and yourself? You have 60
seconds. Well, let me point out that the FOP leadership had no choice to endorse me because the rank and file supported me overwhelmingly. And the FOP has joined the Sergeants Union and 17 other labor unions in endorsing me. A couple things I want to make. When I negotiated the collective bargaining agreement between the city and the FOP, I accepted no money. Unlike my opponent, who continues to remain a paid consultant, paid lobbyist for the Chicago Teachers Union. Secondly, I refuse to take any campaign contributions, unlike my opponent, who is primarily funded by the Chicago Teachers Union and their affiliates. In fact, they're actually taking money out of the teacher contributions union contributions in order to help finance the campaign. So, and they're doing it on a monthly basis. So, again, I'm not beholden to any entity. At the end of the day, being able to negotiate a contract that included all the accountability provisions that had been resisted suggests that I have the capacity to negotiate with any labor leader.
So I'm going to give you another 30 seconds and walk me through what those conversations were like as they were endorsing you. Did they make any specific asks of you to endorse you?
No, none at all. None at all. I don't think they had a choice. If you remember, at one time, I think Mr. Catanzara had actually contemplated running himself. So at the end of the day, I don't think they had a choice. It was the same thing with the sergeants. And initially, the sergeants had decided not to endorse, but the rank and file basically compelled them to provide reconsideration, and they then endorsed me overwhelmingly. So there's no quid pro quo, and it's one of the reasons I didn't take compensation from them, and a precondition for me negotiating was that they accept the accountability provisions.
Mr. Johnson, we're going to give you 60 seconds. The FOP has backed your opponent, as Lord has pointed out, and they've made no secret of their disdain for the current administration. If elected, how would you work to repair the relationship between rank-and-file officers and City Hall?
Yes, you know, I've said over and over again that the best way to make sure that police officers are supported is to give them the opportunity to actually do their job. What we've heard repeatedly from rank and file members of the police department, the Chicago Police Department, is that in many instances, rank and file members do not know who their supervisor is day to day. We do have supervisors who supervise the supervisor. That's like me as a teacher showing up to work every single day and I do not have the same principal in the building. And so one of the things that we have to do is to make sure that there's some consistency in supervision. But we also have to make sure that we pass treatment, not trauma, because it will free up law enforcement to deal with the more violent crime. 60% of the violence that takes place in the city of Chicago, it happens in 6% of the city. And I live in one of those neighborhoods. Supporting police officers, it's not making them do their job in someone else's. Under my leadership, they will be responsible for their job.
All right, thank you. Let's turn now to the city's finances. Mr. Vallis, I turn to you once again. During your last campaign for mayor in 2019, you proposed $250 million in property taxes and $330 million in spending cuts. This time around, you've been less specific about your budget plan. You've talked about finding savings and efficiencies in Chicago's budget. So what specifically are you planning to cut?
Well, let me point out that 4 years ago, things have dramatically changed. Mm-hmm. As you know, the mayor, raised property taxes, and then it took a number of measures in order to basically provide additional funding for the city pension system. So conditions have changed. So have economic conditions, and we're facing a possible recession. So, you know, coming right out and proposing $800 million in tax increases, including potentially an income tax increase, even if that income tax increase is on commuters, a head tax, head tax on businesses, or increasing taxes on the hotel motel industry is the absolute wrong approach to take. I've pointed out that the mayor controls $28 billion in spending, not counting about $400 million in tax increment financing surpluses a year, and not counting the $1 billion in tax increment financing revenues that are skimmed off the top of the property tax bills and sent to almost like a discretionary fund where the mayor decides which developers get what. I think tackling the $28 billion spending that the city does every year is the first order of business and not tax increases.
Let me follow up on this. So under no circumstances would you raise property taxes to pay city pensions. Are there circumstances where you think you would raise property taxes? And walk me through those, 30 seconds.
Well, let me point out that I have no intention on raising property taxes, but more so, I think, even when you have property tax caps or even levy limits, if you're in a gentrifying community, your property taxes still go up by 20-30% because there's a shift in tax liability. So I'm advocating for individual property tax caps on homeowners as well as businesses, or for that matter, people who own apartment buildings, because there's nothing that drives rents up faster than rising property taxes. So this is something that I talked about 4 years ago.
Mr. Johnson, you've not been shy. You've pledged not to raise property taxes, but you've also not been shy about your plan to invest almost $1 billion in support of your agenda. But what is your plan to convince members of City Council to pass these staggering new taxes? 60 seconds.
Yeah, Paul doesn't have a plan. He doesn't. That's essentially what his answer is. And the truth of the matter is, the reason why we have a $2.5 billion property tax bill is because Paul Vallis went to Springfield, worked with Republicans to take away the retirement of seniors. And then he didn't pay into that pension for several years. And so now we're stuck with a $2.5 billion bill. It's a reality. And so under my administration, we're going to fix the structural deficit that Paul Vallis caused in the 90s. We're going to make sure that we provide up to $1 billion of new investments over the first term that I serve. And we're going to do it without raising property taxes. And as far as working with the city council, I'm a part of the legislative branch. I actually know that process. Paul doesn't. He's never been elected to anything. He's never served at the legislative level. And I've been a collaborator. I've been an organizer. I've been a Cook County commissioner. I know how to get things done, unlike Paul.
Mr. Vallis, your opponent says that you caused the structural deficit going back in the 1990s. We'll give you 30 seconds to respond.
I'm surprised he's not blaming me for the Kennedy assassination. Let me point out that I not only left the city systems, pension systems, in their healthiest shape in history, but I left the Chicago teachers' retirement system 100% funded with a statutory guarantee that required that contributions be made in the system to keep them fully funded. So that's a fact. The bottom line is I have passed multi-billion-dollar budgets while holding the line on property taxes. I have capped and left huge surpluses to the Chicago Public Schools while holding the line on property taxes while operating under limited caps. So at the end of the day, I've got a proven record of budgeting and not raising taxes.
Mr. Johnson, back over to you. You've dropped your support for a surcharge on suburban metro riders, and you say that your tax plan is a living document. You want to listen to the people. What happens if people say they don't want any new taxes? 30 seconds.
What people want is they want investment. That's what my budget plan lays out. And I do believe in co-governance and democracy. You know, again, unlike Paul, who did put forth a plan to raise property taxes, even just said it, he has no intentions on raising them. He's going to raise your property taxes. That's why he hasn't put forth a budget plan. His website has three sentences. The fact of the matter is I have the organizational strength and the organizing ability, as I've done as an organizer and as a Cook County Commissioner, to get things done.
Do you want a 15-second rebuttal?
Yeah, absolutely. Incidentally, when I was city budget director, I froze property taxes across the board, fully funded the pensions, and all but one of my budgets passed unanimously. So I was a product of the legislative process. 4 years as a school teacher and the rest of the years as a consultant, And this qualifies him to manage a $20 billion enterprise?
All right, let's stay on the budget issue. Chicago, Mr. Vallis, is on the hook for a roughly $2.5 billion annual pension payment. As we've talked about, revenue from a casino in Chicago is expected to bring in about $200 million or so. Financial experts from the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability have criticized your plan to use TIF money to help make up some of the difference, saying it's, quote, unreliable. So do you have a backup plan? What is your backup plan? 60 seconds.
Well, first of all, there's different ways of using TIF money, because remember, TIFs are diverting $1.1 billion in property taxes. These are real property taxes. These aren't one-time revenues. And every year, close to $400 million in surpluses are also being generated. What I would want to do is to be able to use those surpluses to put into the pension funds in and above what is already mandatory to put in. And as you know, under Mayor Lightfoot, she significantly increased the funding to the pension systems to bring them kind of to a level funding where they're not going to experience dramatic increases every year. So just as she did this year by putting an additional $250 million into the pension plan, if you use the bulk of the TIF surpluses and also put them into the pension funds, you would significantly increase the health of the systems. And you could also do something else. I've advocated for consolidating all of the investments under a single professional investment board so you can maximize the return to get a better return on your investment.
Mr. Johnson, Chicago has seen major corporations like Tyson, Boeing, and Citadel leave the city, as well as an exodus of retail stores like Macy's, Old Navy, Banana Republic. I want to play for you something you said on WGN in August of 2020 during the George Floyd protest.
Is that the answer? To loot because it's a form of reparations? To loot because that's how they can eat?
The real answer is, how do we make sure? The question is, how do we make sure that people can eat? Look, no one is going to condone behavior that quite frankly speaks to a level of desperation.
So you're not condoning looting.
I'm saying that people are acting out of desperation. We don't want a society that is acting out of desperation, but you have to pay attention to the cries that people have.
Mr. Johnson, 3 years ago during those riots, you seemed hesitant to condemn the looting. So how do you convince businesses to stay in Chicago if they think the mayor sides with rioters and looters? 60 seconds.
No, I wasn't hesitant. Not at all. What I'm saying is that we actually have to understand the pain of people. I said it. No one is going to be okay with a society that is out of control. So I'm not hesitant to say that. What I'm clear about, though, is that if we're not solving crime, if we're not catching these coordinated efforts of smash and grab, that's not going to deter it from happening. That's why I'm grateful to have the support of the top legal officer in the state of Illinois, the Attorney General, Kwame Raoul, where we lay out a vision and a plan to make sure that we are promoting and training 200 more detectives, because we have to solve crime. And that's the number one challenge that we have for the city of Chicago. Whether you're a business owner, a large business owner, if you're a resident of the city of Chicago, we can actually solve crime if we actually put forth smart policing. That's what is required. It's not just about being tough. It's about being smart. And right now, there's not a smart plan. Under my administration, we'll have a smart plan and we'll solve crime.
Let's just be clear, because you said in 2020 that the rioting, that behavior spoke to a level of desperation. So just to be clear, that doesn't mean that you're saying it's okay to riot.
No, it's not okay to riot. What I'm saying is that it is important that we understand the level of desperation that's in the city of Chicago has to be addressed. And what my public safety plan does, what my education plan does, what my budget plan does, it actually invests in people. You know, the safest cities in America all have one thing in common. They invest in people. We fully fund our neighborhood schools. We make sure there's economic development. We make sure that those who imbibe the entrepreneur spirit have an opportunity to actually build a business and grow it. That's what my plan calls for. That's why I'm committed to investing in the city of Chicago, because that's what the city of Chicago deserves.
All right, Mr. Vallis, we move on to you. Since the February 28th election, you have received millions of dollars in campaign donations from top executives in the business and finance world. So how can you ensure you will remain independent from those parties if you are elected? You have 60 seconds.
Well, I think my whole history has demonstrated my independence. Taking all the school construction programs out of the Public Building Commission when I basically spent $3.2 billion building 78 new schools, never had to close a single school in Chicago. Or going to New Orleans after Katrina, when 100 of the 110 schools had been destroyed or been rendered uninhabitable after Katrina. Or for that matter, probably at the peak of my public service, going to Haiti, not once but 40 times, chairing Sean Penn's organization, CORE, which provided a place for those who have been displaced by the earthquake. A quarter million people died, and we literally took care of 50,000 Haitians for five consecutive years. So I think I've always demonstrated my ability to be guided by my heart and by my sense of public service and not to be beholden to special interests. This is one of the reasons I did not accept money from the Fraternal Order of Police.
All right. You touched on education, and that is our next topic tonight. You both have deep backgrounds in education. Mr. Vallis, in 2002, when you took over the school district in Philadelphia, you turned 45 schools over to private managers and restructured 21 more schools. The district ultimately faced a $72 million shortfall, and the Pennsylvania budget secretary said you failed to monitor the books properly. How do you assure voters that what happened in Philadelphia is not going to happen here in Chicago? 60 seconds.
Let me respond by saying that I actually did not take the superintendent's job in Philadelphia. I had actually met with Jerry Jordan, the head of the Chicago Philadelphia Teachers Union, Tom Reese, the head of the Chicago Teachers Union. He set up the meeting along with Ted Kirsch, who passed away, to in effect tell the legislature and to tell the governor's office, who were recruiting me, that I would not go if they privatized an additional school. Period. It's simple as that. And that two-thirds of the money that they were going to allocate to the private school operators had to be allocated to the traditional schools. And what we did do was we spent the money on 21 failing traditional public schools that we, in effect, upgraded. And those schools outperformed the privatized schools that had been privatized by the previous administration. And we were off and running. I balanced 5 out of 6 budgets, including my last budget. And look, you know, you have a city potentially facing a budget deficit of anywhere from $500 million to $1 billion down the road. And basically closing the $75 million budget hole was something that I was able to do very easily.
Let me give you 30 more seconds, because part of the question was the district ultimately faced a $72 million shortfall. So explain where that shortfall is coming from.
Well, the shortfall came from three places. First of all, we did a early retirement program, and three times the number of individuals took advantage of it, which means our payouts were three times larger than expected. We also had a delay in returns. The state of Pennsylvania actually funds most of your capital monies for school improvements, and there were a delay in reimbursement. So there were a number of reasons why the deficit ballooned, but I closed the deficit, and I left my successor with a balanced budget, a structurally balanced budget. Let me also point out, during that period, over a 9-year period, reading scores doubled and math scores tripled across all demographics.
Mr. Johnson, you've been highly critical of your opponent's approach to education. A 2017 study by the University of Chicago said that while charter schools have higher turnover, students also showed improvement in test scores, attendance, and college enrollment. Are there any positive aspects of charter schools you would implement if elected? 60 seconds.
Now, I wonder if we could ask it this way. Why do children in the city of Chicago have to apply for a public education? Why is it a radical idea to believe that public education at the expense of the state, after all, is a Negro idea? Those are the words of W.E.B. Du Bois. Why do we make it so hard for families to find a good, fully funded neighborhood school? The fact of the matter is that under Paul Vallis's leadership, he privatized schools, which set up the process for schools to be closed. There's a $2.5 billion structural deficit, property tax bill from Paul Vallis, an $80 million deficit in Philadelphia. Two-thirds of New Orleans school district has been privatized. It has been described as the most inequitable school district in the entire country. He has failed everywhere he has gone. What we have to do in the city of Chicago is make public education a guaranteed right, not a privatized system that stratifies our district.
Mr. Vallis, we're going to give you 30 seconds. Mr. Johnson is right that in New Orleans, most of the schools are charter schools. 30 seconds.
Okay, so let me respond that when I came to New Orleans, 100 of the 110 buildings were actually They have been destroyed. They were uninhabitable. So I actually had to build a brand new system. So we created a system of independent schools. Charter schools are public, not-for-profit schools. So in New Orleans, all the schools are neighborhood schools with local governing boards. So this idea that I privatized schools, there was no system to privatize. We actually had to build a system from the ground up.
Just want to give you 15 seconds. Do you have a number of how many more charter schools you'd like to see in the city of Chicago?
Well, let me point out that I only opened 15 charter schools. One of those was the Youth Connection Charter Schools for students who had been kicked out of school for one reason or another over the previous years, or students who had been incarcerated and were returning from incarceration. So at the end of the day, I actually limited charter schools to 15.
All right. Let's continue on education. Results from the National Assessment of Educational Progress last fall showed steep declines in math. There were also racial and income disparities in how students perform on the test. Mr. Johnson, the question goes to you. As an educator, do teachers deserve any of the blame for the poor numbers, and how do you plan to improve those math numbers? 60 seconds.
Yeah, listen, we have a funding formula that the Chicago Public Schools has not implemented. It's a new funding formula that bases our investment on the need. And by embracing the funding formula that I organized along with people across the state, by implementing that funding formula, it provides the additional resources that our families deserve. Look, there's a direct correlation between test scores and the economic status of communities. We're not measuring it right. The fact of the matter is we have 20,000 students who are homeless. The vast majority of our students are living in poverty. If we're not addressing the living conditions and the working conditions of our communities, then we're not serious about improving the lives of our children. And so a standardized test that has roots in eugenics to prove the inferiority of black people should not be the measurement in which we determine whether or not a child is actually learning.
So how would, let me give you another 30 seconds. How would you hold teachers accountable on whether their students are doing well or poorly?
So you're asking me whether or not we should hold teachers responsible for poverty. What I'm offering is the perspective of a teacher and a parent, by the way. Three of my children, all three of them attend public schools in the city of Chicago. But I can tell you one of the ways in which we can make sure that children are doing well by making sure that their parents are doing well. That's the biggest difference. The north side of Chicago, 35% of families in the north side of Chicago make $100,000 a year more. Half of the west siders and south siders make less than $25,000 a year. That is the way in which we improve public education, by improving the lives of the people who are raising children.
Let me give Mr. Vallis a second. What is your specific plan to better educate a poor student in a black or a Latino community attending CPS?
Well, first of all, I have to respond. Test scores have plummeted in the Chicago Public Schools. 6% of black children are meeting state standards in math and 11% in reading. It's abysmal. And they've lost 10 years of gain, in large part because the schools were shut down for 15 consecutive months, despite the fierce opposition by Janice Jackson, who the CEO, who ultimately left in frustration. So, and not only did test scores plummet, but the district lost 11% of its population during that period of time. And violent crime committed against school-age youth and committed by school-age youth skyrocketed. 200 school-age youth, 17 years and younger, murdered on the streets of Chicago. 95% of them were not enrolled in school. And right now, the truancy rate, average daily, is 42%. So please don't lecture me on education issues, because the Chicago Teachers Union leadership have wreaked havoc on the Chicago Public Schools.
So what is your plan to make sure that black and Latino students do better?
Very simple. Open the campuses through the dinner hour on weekends, over the holidays, over the summer, and increase the instructional time on task. In addition, create work-study jobs for the high school kids with all the city agencies, departments, and contractors, and the unions that I've had conversations with, who will engage and involve youth in work-study opportunities. Those are things we can do. When I reopened schools in New Orleans, despite the fact that students had been out of school for 2 years, they led the state in test scores for 7 consecutive years.
School closures can resume in 2025. Do either of you envision a scenario in which you would close or repurpose failing schools? And what criteria would you use to make that determination? We'll begin with you, Mr. Vallis, 60 seconds.
Well, Well, what I would do is, first of all, we have tens of thousands of students, almost half the number of students we have in high schools, aged 16 to 25, who are either they're not in school and they don't have jobs. So there's no reason why these buildings cannot be repurposed as alternative schools for overage underachievers. We have Youth Connection charter schools, which is a conglomeration of 20 neighborhood schools that existed long before my arrival, but formed a single entity. They have like 4,000 students enrolled. So you sit down with the community, you talk about repurposing the building, and there's no reason why that building can't be reopened to overage underachieving kids. There is federal money for it. There is state money for it. In fact, the state allows for the opening of adult high schools and for the opening of alternative schools, and they will include the student population into the school aid formula. So that's what I would do with those empty buildings or those buildings that are at 5 or 10% capacity, and that would be effective utilization of those empty buildings.
Mr. Johnson, 60 seconds. Will you close or repurpose schools?
Well, let me just first of all respond to Paul Vellis's claim that teachers were responsible for a 100-year global pandemic. Look, the governor of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, did the right thing by shutting down everything because it was a matter of saving lives. Unlike Paul Vallis, who was supported by the Republican Party, who referred to the governor as a dictator because we were trying to save lives. And I'm grateful that the governor understood and recognized that a global pandemic to save black and brown people's lives, that's the right thing to do, Paul. But because you are hanging out with the extreme Republican Party who did not even believe that the pandemic was real, it's unconscionable for you to blame a 100-year pandemic on Democrats. Not to mention saying that teachers are responsible for violence in the city of Chicago. And Paul, you continue to talk about not being lectured to. Well, maybe if you actually listen to people a little bit better, you wouldn't feel lectured to.
Mr. Vellis, I want to bring you into the conversation, but I'm hoping we could also advance it because your opponent continues to sort of question your Democratic Party credentials. Further the discussion by playing a clip from you talking to Barstool Chicago in February of last year. Take a listen. Mm-hmm.
This city's been dominated by Democrats for like, what is it, 50 or 60 years? I mean, what do we have to show for it?
What did you mean there? Do you think Chicago should elect a Republican?
No, well, first of all, I've always run as a Democrat. I ran with Pat Quinn as his running mate. I ran for mayor as a Democrat. I ran for governor against Rob Blagojevich as a Democrat. So I'm a lifelong Democrat, and that's why I think I have the support of 19 labor unions. But I really have to respond to this issue. I am not blaming teachers. And the Chicago public schools remain closed long after other schools open. The Archdiocese schools opened the year after COVID with no academic loss. In fact, their enrollment grew, and the Chicago public schools enrollment plummeted, and there are thousands and thousands of young people on the street that are lost to the system. So I simply have to respond. I'm not blaming teachers. I'm blaming the CTU leadership.
Mr. Vellis, in 1996, when you were CEO of Chicago Public Schools, that year you banned a coming-of-age novel called Coffee Will Make You Black over what you said was sexually explicit content. Reports from your tenure also state that you limited gay sensitivity training for CPS principals, and you were accused of stopping Planned Parenthood from teaching sex ed in school. Attitudes were certainly different in that time period, but what is your current position on banning books at public schools, gay sensitivity training, and sex education?
Well, let me point out that we actually funded Planned Parenthood. In fact, I think I appropriated $500,000 to Planned Parenthood. Secondly, when it came to, and I don't recall the specific book, We actually had committees of teachers as well as principals who would make recommendations. So at the end of the day, we had curriculum review committees, and they would make the decisions on what books to offer and what books not to offer. Let me point out that I also put domestic partners in all the city school district contracts. I was one of the first public officials to do that. And when I ran for governor against Rob Blagojevich, I supported marriage equality when it was called gay marriage in 2000, 12 years before Joe Biden embraced it. So at the end of the day, my record on supporting the LGBT community is a reason that I have such strong support from the LGBT Chamber of Commerce, as well as individuals like Tom Tunney.
But on gay sensitivity training, back then you blocked a video that would have been shown to CPS principals. Have your thoughts on that evolved? If elected mayor, will you block gay sensitivity training?
Well, first of all, I don't recall the video that you were referring to, but there was actually a lot of opposition within the CTU ranks themselves, particularly Tom Reese, on what was being required and what was not being required. So at the end of the day, we had a very close relationship with the Chicago Teachers Union and Principal Association. So I don't recall the video that you're referring to, but absolutely not. I mean, I would support incorporating those things into the curriculum. We're going back, you know, almost, you know, almost 27 years. So conditions were different there. And I do not recall what the individual issues were with the Chicago Teachers Union.
All right, let's move on to other topics that have made headlines recently. Mr. Johnson, I'm going to go to you. You attacked Mr. Vallis for deleting a 2019 tweet celebrating the official endorsement of the Chicago Republican Party. The fact of the matter is Chicago's municipal election is nonpartisan. Mr. Johnson, are you saying you don't want Republicans to back your campaign? 60 seconds.
What I don't want is someone who fundamentally opposes abortion. The city of Chicago doesn't want it. That's what we don't want. We don't want someone who is supported by leadership that believe that the January 6th insurrection was the right thing to do. What we don't want is someone who is supported financially by people who also financially supported Donald Trump. No, the city of Chicago doesn't want that. What I'm saying is that we actually have democratic principles in the state of Illinois. That the city of Chicago deserves someone who comes from the working class, who understands the value of working class people. Someone who is not going to make it impossible for the children of the city of Chicago to study black history. That's what we don't want. He said it himself. He is a Republican. And he has Republican views.
So, Mr. Vallis, let's give you 30 seconds to respond to that comment.
Let me respond, but don't lecture me on middle-class values. I come from a Greek-American immigrant family, born and raised in the South Side, six veterans in my household, including myself, four police officers, now three, because one decided to become a firefighter, two firefighters, three teachers, and small businesses. And you're going to lecture me on middle-class values? And we're a family of public servants who have dedicated ourselves to public service. So a lot of this nonsense is just another attempt to divert attention from the fact that he wants to defund the police. He wants to raise taxes by $800 million, and he is the wholly owned subsidiary of the Chicago Teachers Union.
Are you trying to divert attention? 15 seconds.
First of all, again, more proof that he's a Republican. The Republican said that President Biden was going to defund the police. The Republican said that Governor Pritzker was going to defund the police. Republican said that Nancy Pelosi was going to defund the police. And now the Republican is saying that I'm going to defund the police. He's a Republican.
All right, let's move on to the next topic. Mr. Vallis, you have come under fire for posts that were liked by your social media accounts, including one on Facebook calling Chicago a hellhole. You claim those accounts are not managed by you personally, so how can Chicago voters trust your management and your hiring skills? 60 seconds.
Well, look, you know, the bottom line here is that some people had access to our Twitter account and tweeted responses, and obviously we had to take the appropriate action to make sure that did not happen again. You know, campaigns can be loosely knit organizations, and we needed to be a little more thorough. You know, I'll certainly be more thorough as mayor. But again, you know, we were surprised, and obviously myself, I tend not to respond to social media at all because I'll only look at the negative comments and I'll dwell on them for days. So I've known just for my own mental well-being not to do that. But we pointed out the fact that individuals or someone had gotten access to our account and they were doing it. And they continued to try to do that even after we shut down the system for a day or two. And we took the appropriate steps to make sure that we were able to secure our account so that that would not happen again.
So let me follow up on this. Was it someone working within your campaign that liked those tweets and sent out those comments?
Well, the problem, you know, the problem was we really weren't sure who was doing it because people move in and out of campaigns freely. And I quite frankly am open with sharing my email addresses and communicating with people. You know, I still have my Neutrina area code phone that I've used and that I've circulated throughout the city along with my email. So sometimes, you know, you can be open and people can basically get access and then they can do things that are inappropriate. But we pointed that out the day it happened and indicated the steps we were taking to correct it.
Okay. Gentlemen, a question for both of you. The outgoing administration is in the process of cutting off public access to live and real-time scanner transmission from the Chicago Police Department. You both previously committed to restoring the ability for the public to hear these live transmissions. What is your timeline for restoring full access? Mr. Johnson, 60 seconds.
Yeah, look, as soon as possible, right? We need to make sure that we are doing everything in our power to make sure that we have a free, open society. Look, I understand some of the trepidation around it because many of these dynamics are sensitive. You know, but again, this is why I put forth a comprehensive public safety plan. To ensure that we are using the best possible tools to keep our community safe. And so if the tool doesn't work, then we get rid of the tool, right? But we also have to make sure that we're being responsible, particularly when it comes to our investments. But look, what we should be working towards are real violence prevention measures. That should be the goal, and that is my goal, and that's how my leadership will be conducted as the mayor of the city of Chicago, is to make sure that we're doing everything in our power to reduce violence. The data has proven over and over again, by hiring young people, and I've served as a public school teacher, I've looked into the eyes of individuals who do not feel hope. By hiring young people, there's a direct correlation between youth employment and violence reduction. That's what our focus has to be, on doing what works.
Mr. Vallis, 60 seconds. What is your timeline for restoring full access?
Yeah, quickly, let me preface my remarks by pointing out that I've laid out a plan for the better part of 4 years on how to create universal work study in all of the high schools and to create paid work study programs for returning citizens, because in many communities there are a huge number of individuals who have returned from incarceration and they can't get housing, they can't get into occupational training, they can't get income subsidies, and they can't get jobs from because they're barred. And I've done a whole series of op-ed pieces on that. Look, you need to restore it. I mean, it's ridiculous. And you need to go beyond that, because the city tries to control data. And whether it's the data on transmissions, on crimes that are actually happening, or whether it's the Hilco audit, or it's the Angela Young audit. I mean, the city must become transparent when it comes to the dissemination of data. And I believe that the failure to allow people to access that data really puts people in harm's way, because when crimes are being committed around the block, you need to know about it. So I think, so I would support basically eliminating that restriction on day one.
Okay, time flies when you're having fun, gentlemen. We've come to the end of our debate. Unbelievable. You've each been given 30 seconds to make your closing statement to Chicago voters. Mr. Johnson, you'll go first.
Look, there's a clear distinction here and a very clear choice. The politics of old that have failed families for a generation now, or a better pathway forward. I'm running to become the next mayor of the city of Chicago is because I believe that our promises have to be as big as the city of Chicago. It's why my campaign has caught fire. From Jefferson Park to Morgan Park and everywhere else in between, we have the ability to set a new course. A better, stronger, safer Chicago is possible. I'm counting on you, Chicago. BrandonForChicago.com and, of course, Punch 5.
Mr. Vallis, 30 seconds for your closing statement.
Well, I'm glad you talked about the clear distinctions. Look, fundamental differences. Right off the bat, he believes we should raise taxes $800 million without even taking the first steps to evaluate and assessing the $28 billion that the city is spending. Secondly, I have no confidence under Mr. Johnson's leadership that the schools and the school children and even the teachers will really be the priority, because shutting schools down 15 months, particularly after schools were reopening all over the city. And then thirdly, defunding the cops. I support filling the rank and file vacancies. He does not.
All right, gentlemen, you have made it. I want to thank you for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
And that is the end of our Chicago mayoral debate tonight.
And to our viewers at home, thank you for watching. Early voting has already started across Chicago. And, of course, Election Day is April 4th.
And, of course, we hope you'll join us then to watch the votes come in. Good night.